In 2015, on the 30th anniversary of the Bradford City fire, Martin Fletcher published a book. In it, he told his story. As a boy, he'd been at the fire that day. He'd lost his brother, dad, uncle, and granddad. But the book wasn't just a memoir. It covered the work Martin had been doing in trying to find out what had really happened. Martin points out that Bradford City's former chairman, Stafford Higginbotham, had been linked to at least 8 other fires. Many of those fires led to insurance payouts, money that went to Higginbotham or his company. This was all going on before the fire at Valley Parade.
We thought we'd put it to bed. And then suddenly, the Guardian and this chap who wrote the book suddenly came out. They made no inquiries. They didn't notify us or ask anybody involved in the inquiry about it. It was journalism of the worst sort.
That's Sir Oliver Popplewell, who led the inquiry into the fire. It concluded it was started when a dropped cigarette or match lit rubbish underneath the wooden stand. It was an accident. That was the long and short of it. Sir Popplewell is now 95. I went to meet him at his London chambers. I want to move on to Stafford Higginbotham himself, because as I'm sure you'll be aware, he had multiple businesses, was a very successful businessman. Premises that his businesses were linked to were associated with 8 fires. Does that strike you as unusual?
It came as a surprise. But once the insurers, they insured him because they were perfectly satisfied, obviously, that there was nothing untoward about the previous fires.
The insurers believed there was nothing untoward?
Well, if they didn't believe that, they wouldn't have insured him.
Do you acknowledge, though, that, of course, there's a difference between the resources that an insurance company will put into assessing whether someone is reliable or if something untoward is going on, and the resources that the police would put into an inquiry after, you know, a fire that resulted in the death of over 50 people?
In this case, the insurers had a real financial interest.
At the end of the last episode, you heard how the journalist Paul Foote uncovered Stafford Higginbotham's link to multiple fires prior to the inquiry. Paul assumed it was important information, writing, "No doubt this matter will be considered by the Popplewell inquiry." But that wasn't the case. So were you relying on the conclusions of the insurers then?
Not at the time, because we didn't know about this. The police gave their evidence about what had happened. And they didn't mention anything about his previous cases. So
it's a really interesting point. Do you think, you just said you didn't know about the links to multiple fires. If you had have known that at the time that evidence would have been taken or was taken, would you have considered that?
And if I was told that the insurers had, knowing this, had agreed to insure the ground, had agreed to represent Mr. Higginbotham at the inquiry, had agreed to pay thousands, if not millions of pounds for compensation, I would have accepted it. Insurers aren't bloody fools, and they don't dish out money. Insurers could have repudiated if they'd found anything at the inquiry which led them then to suspect sabotage, arson.
I understand. So there's a kind of reliance upon the conclusions that the insurance companies made.
Well, of course.
No matter what Oliver Popplewell says about the actions or scrutiny of the insurance company, he did not consider Higginbotham's previous fires at the inquiry. That's just a fact, and a pretty uncomfortable one, I reckon, but not for Popplewell.
I mean, this is the simplest case. Honestly, of all the cases I've ever, well, not all the cases, but most of the cases I've ever tried, that I've ever tried.
Do you really believe that?
Of course I do.
One of the simplest cases he's ever tried. Well then, it's about time we look at the evidence that allowed him to come to that conclusion.
People are spilling onto the pitch. We can see the flames going up into the air there. Take the time. Don't rush. Don't push. Work for the kiddies. We're taking a break. We're getting out of it.
From What's the Story Sounds, this is 900 Degrees. I'm Mubeen Azar. Chapter 5, A Dropped Cigarette.
A good fire investigation now is not just about what started the fire, it's what didn't start the fire.
Nigel Adams was in the fire service for 30 years, the last 12 years of which he was a fire investigator.
Since leaving the fire service, I've also conducted fire investigations independently, and I've lectured on numerous crime scene investigation courses around the country at different universities.
Nigel is going to help me get my head around the forensic fire investigation into the cause of the blaze at Bradford.
There will always be incidents where you might put a list of two or three possible ignition sources, and you might put them in ranking order of what you think's most likely. It's the most unlikely, or vice versa. But you will always narrow it down to one or two, maybe three, but they would all need to take serious consideration.
Police said tonight that after a painstaking search of the main stand by forensic scientists, they hadn't yet discovered the cause of the fire. But they've still not ruled out arson.
This is a report from ITN News the day after the fire. Back then, all options were on the table. There were rumours and speculation, and initially talk of a smoke bomb being thrown into the stand. The Daily Star ran with it. I've got the Daily Star, this article written by Mr. Truman on the 13th of May, so that's 2 days after the fire. Listen to this. A smoke bomb caused the Bradford fire. I'm convinced of it. I was sitting only yards away from the seat of the inferno. I saw everything. I saw every horrifying second. I saw a smoke bomb thrown by hooligans from the stand adjoining the main building, and I know that the killer who threw it would have escaped. It's pretty unambiguous. A smoke bomb is hardly discreet. I mean, that's the point. It's a smoke bomb. So the problem is, nobody else saw it. In fact, nobody in G Block, where the fire started, recalled any such incident, and there was no sign of it on TV either. So even though this theory made it into the press, it was rejected. If you think this sounds familiar, maybe it's because you remember the reporting on the Hillsborough disaster 4 years later. After 96 people lost their lives, the Sun newspaper wrongly blamed fans for causing the deaths. For decades, that was the accepted reality. Today we know it just wasn't true. As for Bradford, the idea that the fire was started by a hooligan was rejected. Popplewell described Mr. Truman's evidence as not reliable. I guess the most obvious question is, what evidence is there that the fire was in fact caused by a dropped cigarette or a lit match? After all, the wooden stand had housed countless fans, many of them smokers, for over 80 years without incident. What are the chances that the stand would burn down from a single dropped cigarette or match on supposedly the last day of its existence? Thanks to live TV and an off-duty officer who'd taken some photos of the fire, detectives were able to work out where the fire started. Underneath the seats of G Block, underneath rows I or J, and beneath seats 141 to 143. That's pretty specific, right? Well, fans from the section were asked as part of the inquiry if they'd smoked or seen anybody else smoking.
We certainly knew their names. One or other of them dropped either a lighted cigarette or a lighted match, but we weren't going to identify them for obvious reasons. It would have been very unfair to blame them. No one suggested they'd done it deliberately. If you take the view that it was an accident, what's the most likely when you exclude deliberate arson? You come to the conclusion and it's the most likely. And everyone in the Home Office, when we went back, no one said, you're balmy, you know. this can't happen. It was about as straightforward, I thought, as you could get. A layman looking at it could have come to the same conclusion.
When I started on this path in the year 2000, I expected to find testimony or an eyewitness statement that proved categorically who was smoking at the relevant time in order to have caused the fire.
This is Martin Fletcher.
There is no such testimony, there is no such eyewitness statement. There never was, there never will be. Therefore, I cannot see any basis for believing that the official verdict into the Bradford fire is a safe one upon the evidence.
If you scrutinise the testimonies given to the Popplewell inquiry, you get, well, you get a really confused picture. I've got a bunch of testimonies from people. These were given to the police just after the fire. And they're all from people who were sitting in or around the Point in G block, which is where we know the flames first appeared. So the first one is a Mr. Philip Levitt. He was a non-smoker. He claims to remember smelling cigarette smoke around 20 minutes before the fire first appeared, but nothing afterwards. When he was asked whether he remembered anybody around me smoking, his response was "not that I noticed." An off-duty police officer called DC Blanchfield was in seat I-146 with three children. He told the inquiry that he kept a more particular eye on those around him, but saw nobody smoke during the match. Then we've got a Mr. Rufus Kolawole, who was sat in seat J-142, the very spot where the fire is said to have started. So he's right in the middle of everything that unfolded. He says he was a former smoker who now found the smell of cigarette smoke, quote, "very obnoxious." He says he does remember cigarette smoke around 20 minutes into the match, and he's certain that was the only indication of a cigarette being smoked. Then we've got Mr. Leslie Brownlee, who was sat in seat I-142. He says he does recall smoking early on in the game, but he then says he didn't knock any embers from his pipe before putting it back in his pocket, effectively saying there wasn't an issue, it wouldn't have set fire to anything. You see where I'm going with this? It's just a bunch of people saying they saw some people smoking. Back then, at a match, that was completely normal. As far as evidence goes, well, this isn't it. But there was one person who did claim they saw something more definitive.
This article is from the 15th of May 1985, so that's 2 days after the fire. And the headline is "Cigarette Butt Started Bradford Stadium Fire, Survivor Says." So in this report, it says that Ches Pakela, who's a 29-year-old commercial artist, has spoken to the Telegraph in Argus, that's Bradford's local paper. And in it, he says, quote, "he saw an older man drop something that started a fire near him." And then he continues, "I think he'd put a cigarette out in a plastic cup, which then fell through a gap in a floorboard." And the quote ends, "there was a smell of burning polystyrene."
This version of the story was given to a local paper. The issue is, by the time it went to the inquiry, Ches Pakela had told police that the reports were misquoted and totally incorrect. He continued, "I never said that. I never saw anyone ducking any cigarettes in any plastic cup."
This felt ominously familiar, you know, this kind of rather lazy inference that it was actually a fan who'd caused it. The fan who unwittingly had dropped the cigarettes or the tobacco smoke or whatever back onto the fans. So it must be, you know, it's their own doing.
Ian Herbert is a sports journalist who in 2015 worked at the Independent newspaper.
I think that the dropped match is an accepted conclusion. Although I think that the fact that the inquiry was so brief and the scramble for evidence for that inquiry was so frenetic, there were real inadequacies. You know, the 5.5 day inquiry into the Bradford disaster was just grossly inadequate, and there was something that needed investigating.
After Martin's book came out, a whole bunch of journalists began to question the official version of events. The testing to establish the cause of the fire was led by Dr. David Woolley and Roy Cook. I asked Nigel Adams, that's the fire investigator, to examine the work that was done in 1985.
Cook, who did the initial fire investigation, wrote the very, very first fire investigation book published in his country. And some of the things that they mention in their book is, you know, test your hypotheses. I think the closest thing I saw to a test in the Bradford City fire was that at some point, somebody had held a cigarette in their hand and dropped it on the floor and it stayed alight.
Let me break this down. It was in fact 48 matches, not cigarettes, that were lit and dropped to the floor. That was the test, to try to work out if a dropped match could have caused the fire. 35 out of 48 matches went out. That means less than a third stayed lit. Add to that the fact that a lit match would have had to then land perfectly to fall through a gap in the stand and then ignite rubbish, which would also need to be positioned perfectly and dry enough to burn. There are a lot of variables here, and that's all that was done to test the lit match theory.
That's not enough for me. You know, these are such serious issues. We're talking about such loss of life, such tragedy, that you do need to have something more fundamental to base that assumption on than that.
Ian's not convinced. He visited the National Archive at Kew Gardens, where papers relating to the inquiry are held, and found even more reasons to question the verdict.
In those public records at Kew, the fire research station's director, Dr. David Woolley, there was quite a lot of correspondence from him, which just really made it quite clear in terms of the tone of the correspondence that he'd been given just too little time to investigate. He was desperately trying to find photographs from West Yorkshire Police and documentation just to try to pull something together in time.
If we have a look at some of the fires that happened on or around the time of the Bradford City fire, and if we go back a little bit further, so we go back to before that, we look at the Summerland Disco fire on the Isle of Man. 2nd of August 1973, 50 deaths. The inquiry started in September 73, then went on pretty much continuously then till the end of February 74. There was an extensive fire investigation carried out by John Webb from the Fire Research Station, and his report on its own went to 300 plus pages. If we jump forward a bit and we go to the next big fire, we go to the 18th of November 1987, which was the King's Cross fire. Resulted in 31 deaths. The inquiry started in February 1988 and ran solidly until June 1988. They ran two reconstructive tests. They incorporated computer generations and computer simulations. And the fire investigation report ran to 287 pages. And then we look at Grenfell Tower. We all know about Grenfell Tower.
In case you don't know, the fire at Grenfell Tower in June 2017 saw 72 people lose their lives. That inquiry is still going. The point is, these fires all resulted in lengthy inquiries and extensive public reports.
And then we go to the Bradford City stroke Birmingham City. So two incidents there, not just one. Happened on the 11th of May 1985, resulted in 56 deaths at Bradford and one death at Birmingham City. Inquiry was commenced in June 1985 and ran for 5 days. There are short published reports which allude to the fire investigations, but there's not much out there in the public domain about the fire investigations. That has always been the hook for me, if you like. I just don't think they gave the people that were carrying out the investigations enough time to do their job properly.
So if you look at the Bradford City fire, you've got evidence being heard over 5 days. If you look at the King's Cross fire, for example, that's a 5-month inquiry, 287 pages delivered. Grenfell, you'll be aware, that inquiry is ongoing. So the first phase of that lasted 7 months. That produced an 838-page report. In Bradford City, after that fire, evidence is heard over 5 days. You've got a technical fire assessment that ran to 12 pages. Why is there a disparity, do you think? I put this to Oliver Popplewell.
Because the evidence required it. I mean, we don't do it by length of time. We do by what is required by the evidence. Once you've got the evidence as to what had happened and no alternative suggested, in fact it being unanimous, There wasn't any point spreading it over 3 years or 5 years or whatever is thought to be the proper length of time.
Do you believe it was adequate time, essentially?
Of course.
With the King's Cross fire, part of that inquiry involved reconstructions of the escalator and tests being carried out there. There's computer modelling, which is often used now in trying to work out how fires have started. Obviously, none of that happened with the Bradford City fire.
Well, you say obviously. So the Home Office conducted a very simple test after we'd heard the evidence, dropping lighted matches onto debris. And rather surprisingly, as it surprised me, it didn't work very often.
Do you think dropping lit matches is comparable to
computer
modelling?
No, of course it isn't, but you didn't need much. You didn't need to be an expert to know if you drop a lighted match onto debris of that sort, sooner or later it'll start burning.
It just doesn't sound convincing to me. Here's Nigel Adams.
All you're doing is establishing facts as a foreign investigator, and then you're laying those facts down in front of whoever requires them. They say, we've put this together quick. This is a quick report. We've been asked to supply within the quick time frame. And I think they'd have probably done an awful lot more if they could have done. But they've done the job of saying it's one or the other. It's either careless disposal or it's deliberate ignition. Where they say in the one part of their report that it's possible but not probable that a cigarette started it, and it's more likely that there was another cause, the only other cause from the evidence that I've seen would have been deliberate ignition.
In the past month, theories have emerged that the fire may have been caused deliberately. But now we can reveal for the first time the name of the man who told detectives he had accidentally started the fire.
This isn't new information. When Martin's book came out in 2015, some parts of the press did ask fresh questions, but a bucket of water was poured over that by a BBC Look North report called Missed Warnings, which also first aired in 2015.
Investigators held a reconstruction in Bradford Police Station to help witnesses recall the events. Everyone who'd been seated in G Block were asked to attend. After excluding those who were injured and those who had died, the occupants of just two seats remained unaccounted for.
So we asked the people who were sat next to these two empty seats. One recollection was that the two gentlemen were an old man and his son, middle-aged son. And the old man had emigrated a long, long time ago from Bradford.
Right, so this is the retired detective who worked on the investigation. He's called Raymond Faulkner.
The missing men were actually an uncle and nephew. They were visiting from Australia, and the hunt was now on to find them. After exhaustive house-to-house inquiries, Raymond Faulkner knocked on a door in South Bradford.
It was answered by a gentleman who invited us in, and before we chanced to even introduce ourselves, he simply says, I've been waiting for you.
And then there's this man who'd returned from Australia for the game. He's called Samuel Bennett. And then listen to this. The retired Faulkner gives a pretty definitive answer to the question of what caused the fire.
He said he smoked a cigarette, dropped the cigarette onto the floor in front of him, went to put his foot on it, but it unfortunately dropped through, he said, a knot hole.
Mr. Bennett said he tried to put the fire out by pouring his coffee on it, but within minutes, smoke had returned, this time accompanied by flames.
The truth is that he dropped a cigarette, and he was quite unequivocal about it. He dropped the cigarette that started the fire.
That was that. For a large section of the press, at least. 2015, appearing in a doc to mark the anniversary of the fire, the retired detective Raymond Faulkner put to bed any speculation about the cause. Here's journalist Daniel Taylor.
Well, Raymond Faulkner poured a considerable amount of cold water all over Martin's story and told everyone about how it didn't configure with his evidence.
But Martin Fletcher isn't so sure that the police were right. In fact, he's got information which contradicts what Raymond Faulkner claimed in that documentary.
I have Samuel Bennett's statements. He didn't go missing for a week or so. He gave a statement the day after the fire, and Raymond Faulkner never witnessed any of the four statements I've got from Samuel Bennett.
Martin has in his possession four police statements taken from Samuel Bennett in the aftermath of the fire. The first was taken just the day after. So the idea that Bennett was an elusive witness, that he was hard to track down, doesn't seem quite right. But what did Bennett tell the police?
Well, I mean, Samuel Bennett's saying, I have no idea how this fire began. I mean, you know, this guy turns up at a football match and a fire begins. And it's like, what happened there? He hasn't got a clue. I mean, I have no idea how this fire began. I mean, he's invited back to give three, if not four, further statements by West Yorkshire Police. And he sticks to what he said in his original statement, which is, I have no idea how this fire began.
Bennett did end up giving a bunch of statements to the police, got them in front of me. And Martin is right, actually, because on the day after the fire, Bennett says, I have no idea how the fire began. In another statement, taken on the same day, he admits smoking a couple of cigarettes, but then he adds, I cannot remember dropping a lighter, match or cigarette end at my feet, or even exactly what I did with them. Then there's a later statement, taken a week later, on the 19th of May, and in that he says, I can add nothing to my previous statements. There's one more statement, given on the 4th of June, so that's a few weeks after the fire now, and again, he adds nothing of note about the origin of the fire. He does at that point explain that his nephew had told him he'd tried pouring tea on the fire to put it out. The fact is, though, and this is the important bit, in all of these statements, I cannot see one thing that could be even construed as a confession from Bennett. What on earth is going on here? If Faulkner's claims are true, then Samuel Bennett had changed his statement at the fifth time of asking. But what made him change his mind? Was it the guilt of causing the blaze that became too much? Well, not according to his nephew, who was sat next to him in the stadium that day. This isn't about taking sides, of course. All it is an attempt to try to get to the facts, or as close to the facts as we possibly can. And I've got this article from The Telegraph in front of me, and this was published just after this documentary comes out. And in it, there's an interview with Samuel Bennett's nephew. He's called Leslie Brownlee, who was at the game. And he says his uncle had nothing to do with the Bradford fire whatsoever. So let me read you this section. A distraught Briton who was in the stadium during the Bradford City fire, which killed 56 football fans, has attacked a, quote, mind-bogglingly inaccurate BBC documentary that claims his uncle admitted to dropping the cigarette that caused the blaze. He continues, the man is dead and can't defend himself. I'm bloody annoyed about this report. Asked if he thought there was any chance Mr. Bennett's cigarette started the fire, Mr. Brownlee said, I'm quoting directly, no, none at all. He wouldn't have dropped a cigarette. I don't know where Faulkner is getting this cock and bull story from. The inaccuracies in this report, he's talking about the documentary there, the inaccuracies are dumbfounding. It's fair to say that a lot of people would get defensive if their uncle was named as the cause of a fire that killed 56 people. But there are two very different accounts of what Samuel Bennett said and did that day. We invited Raymond Faulkner to this podcast, but he declined. He did say that Samuel Bennett's fifth statement did exist and was with West Yorkshire Police. We asked them about this statement, but they didn't respond. Crucially, Faulkner sticks with his version of events, but we haven't seen the fifth statement. And what seems really odd is it wasn't seen by Oliver Popplewell. There's no evidence that Faulkner did anything wrong here, but some journalists are quick to point out his involvement in another case where a confession was found to be unreliable.
The Bradford Telegraph Nada introduced him as a top detective. I'm not so sure that that's the case.
Daniel Taylor was a childhood friend of Martin Fletcher. He also happened to be The Guardian's chief football writer in 2015.
All it needs is a little bit of research. It doesn't need very much at all to realise that in reality, He was one of the detectives on the Carol Wilkinson murder case, which goes down as one of the biggest miscarriages of justice of its time.
Yeah, I'm Peter Hill. I was a journalist for BBC Television, and I created lots of investigations, but particularly the Rough Justice series, totally devoted to miscarriages of justice.
Peter Hill and the Rough Justice team at the BBC had made a programme about the conviction of a man called Anthony Steele. He spent 19 years in prison for the murder of Carol Wilkinson. A Detective Falconer, yes, the same Detective Falconer, played a key role in that investigation.
Anthony Steele, he was a rough lad. He was a nice lad. He was a gardener. He worked for the council. But he was in and out. He was very lazy, lackadaisical.
Carol Wilkinson had been murdered on her way to work in Bradford. The original investigation into the killing drew a blank. But this is where Anthony Steele's name came up. His mother-in-law, Vera, told the police he was the killer. It's a really messy story. It starts when Vera's daughter, that's Anthony's wife, comes home with a fish-shaped keyring.
And Vera said, oh, that's new. Where did you get it? She said, well, Tony gave it to me. And she seemed to recollect that this girl, Carol Wilkinson, had a fish keyring. It had been stolen from her. He's guilty. So she told Pudsey police. Ah, God, with the pressure they were under, they were onto it in a flash. Here they had a link.
You don't have to be a detective to know that link wasn't exactly a smoking gun. But Carol Wilkinson's murder was huge news. At the time, West Yorkshire police were hunting the Yorkshire Ripper as well, so the public were demanding answers. Cue Detective Faulkner.
Ray Faulkner was a robbery squad man. He'd just been seconded from the robbery squad because they didn't have any more murder squad detectives.
Faulkner picked up the story about the fish keyring and started asking questions.
It was a bit unfortunate that when they read the reports, there was nothing about a fish keyring in it at all. They had all her possessions. They'd even interviewed all her family about things. And God knows, when they actually took this fish keyring around to Carol's family, her mother said, I don't know anything about that. Her father said, no, she didn't have that. Went to her sister where she'd lived for 6 months. She said, no, Carol didn't have a keyring. I'd have known, she said.
That wasn't the end of it. There were other people who'd known Carol, including three young men from the Best family.
He got this fish keyring, dangled it in front of the three Best boys. He said, is that hers? One of them had real doubts about it, but eventually they thought, well, it must have been hers. Yes.
Anthony Steele was arrested. He was interviewed for hours on end and had no legal representation. Decades later, referring to the police, Steele said, they kept intimidating me, telling me what I did that day. I think I ended up believing what they were telling me.
Well, of course, you deny it, don't you? You deny it and you deny it. You know what the truth is. You deny it. But they seem to have evidence that says you're wrong. You come to believe they must be right. Your memory must be wrong. They must be right because they're so insistent. After all, they're the police, aren't they? But he was adamant that he hadn't done it. But he was told when he signed that document, A, he could go home, and B, he could have a solicitor. Never been a great reader, and he just signed it because he wanted to get home. He wanted to get home to his mum.
That document was an admission of guilt. Anthony Steele was charged and later convicted of the murder of Carol Wilkinson. He went on to spend 19 years in prison.
How do you defend a man who's confessed to murder?
Peter Hill and the Rough Justice team got a psychiatrist to analyse the confession. It was entirely discredited. Steele was found to have a low IQ and was abnormally suggestible. Questions were raised about whether he should have been subjected to an interview at all without an appropriate adult alongside him. In 2003, Anthony Steele was acquitted by the Court of Appeal. West Yorkshire Police apologised for the actions of their officers.
When he eventually came out, I think he lasted 3 years.
Anthony died from a heart attack.
Basically, they killed him in jail.
Why am I telling you this story? Well, it was Detective Faulkner, the officer who claimed to have found the man who started the Bradford fire, who was also one of the interviewing officers when Anthony Steele confessed to a crime he didn't commit. Of course, these cases are not linked, and there's no evidence that Faulkner's involvement in the Bradford fire investigation was anything other than legitimate. But the inconsistencies between his account, the recollections of Samuel's nephew, and the statements I've seen from Samuel Bennett himself create a problem, because they can't all be right. The truth is, Faulkner's account was not heard at the inquiry, and with Samuel Bennett now deceased, we can't ask him. I guess it's a question of who you choose to believe. We asked Raymond Faulkner if he had anything to say about the Steele case, but he declined to comment. From what we now know, the official conclusion about how the Bradford fire started is on really shaky ground. Sir Oliver Popplewell told me there is no alternative to the conclusion that a dropped cigarette or match caused the fire. I just don't believe that's true. How can it be when so little weight has been applied to the theory? The report into the fire references what could have happened, but certainly doesn't tell us what did happen.
There's not a lot there about how the fire started. And what is there about how the fire started is a bit conflicted in my mind, because paraphrasing what's said in a couple of places, it's possible for a cigarette to be dropped and cause that fire, but not probable. So it's almost like we've gone with a cognitive bias here. We want this to be a careless disposal. And as soon as evidence started to come in of a careless disposal, that's what we're going to call it. As opposed to, there's also evidence that it could have been a deliberate ignition. And there are places in there where they say arson should be considered, and it doesn't seem to have been considered. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to tell the difference between a careless disposed of cigarette and somebody deliberately setting fire to something. You then have to have a look at how quick it develops and why it developed and what materials are involved, and that's where we go into histories as well. As a fire investigator, one of the sections on the fire investigation report that we used to fill out was history of previous fires. And that didn't just include that building, it might include the area if there was a spate of fires or a series of fires going on in that area. Or it might include properties owned by the same people. In the Bradford City fire, that doesn't appear to have been done.
Next time on 900 Degrees.
Do I think that somebody started it deliberately?
It just seems such a kind of, you know, colossal risk.
It's a pretty evil conclusion to come to, considering that that stand was packed full of people.
If the gates had been locked at the back of that stand, then hundreds of people would have died that day.
There's absolutely no way he would do anything whatsoever to harm the club.
How would you not investigate that possibility, if only to eliminate that possibility from your considerations?
Nine Hundred Degrees is presented by me, Mubin Azar. The series is produced and edited by Callum McRae. Additional sound design by Tom Bruins. Executive producers are Daryl Brown and Sophie Ellis. Music is supplied by KPM, and our lawyer is Emily Barber at Reviewed and Cleared. 900 Degrees is a What's the Story original podcast made in conjunction with Dragonfly.